Welcome to At the End of the Day. I'm your host, Jason Marinchuk, and I am joined by my esteemed guest, Mr. Jay Burden. Hello, Jay.
Good to finally be on, Jason. I'm looking forward to it.
As we were saying before the show, it's you're basically one of the biggest rising stars out there within this little dissonant sphere. I think I had heard you first on Pete Canonas probably over a year ago, if that's accurate.
Yeah, it is. That is, this is, and I'm sure you'll be aware of this as an interviewer. Doing an interview and being interviewed are two very, very different skills. And on my appearance on Pete's show, I learned that while I was getting kind of good at one, I was not very good at the other. So looking back on it, I'd like to think that I've definitely got better at speaking my mind. But yeah, that was how a lot of people kind of first came across me. I've actually met some like genuine IRL friends from that, which is kind of fun. But yeah, thank you. I appreciate the compliment. I'd like to say that it's some special skill, but a lot of it is just that I record and write a lot. And, you know, anything you do enough, you start to get better at. So I'd like to say it's like a special skill, but I think it's more just repeated iteration over and over again, kind of refining that process.
We got the beavers showing up in the chat.
Oh, yeah. Sorry about that. You're going to get groined. No.
I freaking love it, man. So, okay, explain the beaver thing to anyone who's not, who, because it's in the thumbnail, right?
Yeah, it is. And this is funny because, you know, like many things, this is sort of something that's grown well past its initial relevance. But there's kind of this clip that goes around from time to time from sort of an animal rescue shelter. And it's of a, you know, a beaver fully raised in captivity. You know, it's never seen water. It's never lived with other beavers, but it is still building a dam. Like even in this kind of artificial scenario, it is kind of acting on its memories and arranging the pillows in the house, you know, all its toys in a little pile like a dam. And so from that, you know, there's kind of a deeply held truth in that, which is that, you know, even in unnatural circumstances, you can do something productive, right? You can build, you can kind of do what you were designed to do. But really it's because me and several other people got kind of engrossed in just making a ton of stupid memes and edits about beavers. And then that just kind of grew and grew and grew to the point where I can't get away from it, you know, and anywhere I go, it's just, you know, pages and pages of beavers in the chat.
Okay. So this is interesting because I think I was following one of your chats and I thought it was the most Gen Z thing, like meta thing in the world. Just from your explanation, it still holds true, but I think someone said in the chat that J stands for Justin, or J is for Justin, and Justin Bieber, and Justin Bieber is a beaver, hence beaver. And I was like,
"No, that's not at all true." But to whoever came up with that's actually kind
I think
of funny.
That's I think funnier you just run with that story from now on. That's yeah, that's freaking brilliant.
Jason, you know what? Cut this out of the episode. Let me afterwards say what you just said. That's the new explanation from now on. We've airbrushed the old one out of existence.
Well, it's not for me. It was someone in one of your chats. So hats off to that person. Whoever, if they're listening to this, you know, lay claim, plant a flag in that, you know, make sure you get your commission from Jay if he uses it in the future.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. But just to clarify, I will not be paying for that.
Well, paying in, you know, in virtual roses. We're living in a simulation. Course. It can be like simulated money. It's fine. Jay, here's a question to start off with you. What radicalized you? Have you always been, because you're not even 30 yet.
No, I'm still in my early 20s.
So, yeah, and I go ahead.
Oh, excuse me. So to answer that question of what radicalized me, it's pretty common among people my age, and that's college did. To be honest, I was really lucky to come from kind of a conservative. Oh, okay. Well, it seems like everyone, sorry, Cody Browning, for those who are listening to the audio version, says that he made that meme to prove trans people will never escape being their biological sex. So fair enough. Apparently this is the multivariate beaver origin story. But anyway, to go back to my radicalization, that I kind of grew up in conservative red America. I was lucky enough to come from the Christian classical tradition, which is very focused on the great books. And because of that, I was really in a bubble. It was a good thing for me, but I didn't realize how kind of disconnected I was to culture more broadly. And so being kind of a contrarian person, I was kind of more on the kind of classical liberal left side of things. And then I went to college and I signed up for a course that changed my life. And it was called game theory. And, you know, I went into this expecting some type of like war games, you know, economic game theory. And in actuality, I had a fat blue-haired woman teaching me critical theory of video games, which basically meant that I was taught Gamergate at a collegiate level. And essentially, I ended up actually dropping out of college. It set me into such this like, you know, weird headspace of like, I don't even know what I believe anymore, but I know I hate whatever you are. And, you know, through the process of, you know, really going deep and reading, I was lucky enough to have people who kind of pointed me in the right direction. I sort of came to, you know, the people who were investigating the roots of, you know, kind of the ideology I encountered at school beyond just the level of, you know, SJWs are annoying, they make bad movies, you know, past that level of like, okay, well, like, where did these things come from? You know, what is the, you know, kind of like the origins of liberalism? And so I consider my base in that to be sort of the, you know, elite theory, neo-reaction, and kind of anti-liberal thought. And I came to that really after that encounter in college.
That's a nice little segue to get into elite theory, or as I'm saying, counter elite theory, which might be even more interesting to kind of expand into. You know, I just to build off what you're saying, I think bad teachers for intelligent people are a blessing, because you kind of see the sort of the fallibility of authority early on. I remember when I was a kid, it was like finding out that the teacher had a teacher's copy of the book where all the answers are at the back of the book. I'm like, well, why don't you just give me that copy? If such a copy exists, what are we doing here? So you're telling me there's a thing with all the answers? Give me the answers. I can write down the answers. What are we doing? And that to me, like at age 6 or 7, kind of radicalized me a little bit. Like, I don't think these people actually know what they're talking about.
Well, certainly. And like I said, growing up in kind of a bubble, I was really lucky. And one of the teachers that I had at a, you know, in high school, who is now currently a friend and a recurring guest on my show, is Bagby, right? George Bagby is his pseudonym. And he's been on my show, I think, 8 or 9 times now. And we kind of do these historical deep dives. But he was someone who is very much aware of the conversations people like you and I are having now. For instance, he converted to Orthodoxy back in like 2008. So he's kind of ahead of the curve on that. But, you know, he was someone who was very involved in the anti-war movement, you know, very much connected to the kind of rich tradition of thinkers before the last 20 years. You know, when you and I were kind of talking before about, you know, the libertarian movement, and I think one of the things that's a real disservice to people, and this is less and less the case, but, you know, before you sort of had very, very limited options to sort of oppose the current thing. You know, I remember I kind of grew up during the Obama era, and there was sort of this feeling that, you know, all of the smart people liked Obama, you know, and the only way to oppose him was to be stupid and to like Bill O'Reilly. You know, and obviously that's a very black and white kind of tone deaf way to put it. But I think that a lot of people are kind of looking for that third position. And I think that libertarianism fills that because it has that kind of like neither right nor left. And also because it has that kind of alluring air of we have all the answers, or like here's a kind of a formula you can memorize. I think it's really appealing to people who feel that discontent kind of with the situation as it is and don't necessarily have something set in front of them that kind of gives them an outlet, I guess.
Yeah, as we were saying before the show, one of the things that religion, it's the bitter white pill between the, let's say, religion versus ideology war, is that religion, and especially I'll talk about Orthodoxy, provides what we call a phronema, which is essentially a worldview. It's supposed to be totalizing. It's like you live in that reality, or as I say, the ritual and the reality are one. That which you ritualize becomes your reality. That which becomes your reality is supported by the rituals. It's a sort of a paradox. Buck Johnson once said that Orthodoxy is a dialectic destroyer, or dialectic killer, however he phrased it. And it's that we continually return to paradoxes, that everything you know, there's a classic one from Lords of Spirits, that the much, much vaulted Orthodox podcast, which is that most questions in Orthodox are answered by yes and but. You know, it's like, yeah, yes, but, you know, because you're dealing with some sort of symbolic reality. The strength of this is that an aphronema will tell you, can instruct you how to live your life in all dimensions. An ideology can only do it in one, usually one dimension. So let's say, just to pick on libertarians for a second, but this works for communism or, you know, whatever ism or it that you want, is that it can be great for, let's say, economics or, you know, free markets or private property, the NAP, whatever you want. But outside of that, it fails. It doesn't. Libertarianism can't tell you what to do when your dad dies, or how to raise your kid, or how to address sort of your inner nihilism and feelings of despair, or, you know, how to access meaning and being in this world. Just can't. You know, Evola hits on this perfectly from a outside of a, from almost a secular perspective. And I think it's funny is like, I think if Evola had encountered Orthodoxy, it would have solved all his problems. As Father Seraphim Rose once said about, I forget who he was referencing, but he's like, it's not that he was wrong. It's that he didn't go far enough. And I feel that that's where ideology kind of gets stuck, is that they get to this point and they're like, oh, well, end the Fed and you'll solve all the world's problems. Or as I like to pick on it now, is like the standard liberal frame is like, if you want to solve all of Africa's problems, just solve world hunger and it'll work. I'm like, oh, just that then. Oh, okay. Well, since we're being logical and reasonable about this, you know.
Well, and that's really the, you know, kind of the core situation we find ourselves in, which is that, you know, the 20th century really was the century of ideology, right? And we can take ideology to essentially be, you know, sort of these kind of like neat, you know, mental prisms to fix the world, to just solve it all. And, you know, far from, you know, fixing any problem, effectively the 20th century was the bloodiest in human history. You know, we destroyed an immense amount of, you know, human beings, an immense amount of civilizational capital, which is something we'll come back to later. And, you know, at the end of it, we're sort of left sitting on the ash heap. And if nothing else, you know, we as kind of realists, people who look at the world as it is and not how we would wish it to be, you sort of have to look at ideology and decide like, well, maybe this is the issue. You know, that the idea that we can sort of turn human nature, we can turn the way society is ordered into this kind of idealized version to fix everything, that we can eradicate these kind of like eternal problems of humanity. We can eradicate hunger. We can eradicate inequity. I mean, it's murderous. It's clearly murderous. And, you know, it's very common for people to kind of, you know, point at the speck, which, and I realize using a speck to talk about, you know, the democide is probably a little bit inappropriate, but stand with me for this. But we'll also kind of point in their neighbor's eye and say like, oh, you know, the rightist authoritarians, you know, they killed all these people. You know, the leftists will say like, oh, the rightists will say, oh, it's the communists. And don't get me wrong, communism is a particularly murderous ideology. But at the same time, like the way that ideological states function are murderous, like fundamentally. And so to me, it's like we really are seeing kind of the failure in ideology that, you know, that vein is dry. There's nothing left there. And I think that, you know, framing this as sort of a war of belief, which is, you know, a very different thing than ideology, I think is the correct way to get out of this.
Do you know your Girard?
I do not, actually. I've been recommended him.
Because I've heard you use memetics quite a bit. And you're using it properly. I'm not saying like you're not.
I come to that through Yarvin and Land, who take it, I assume, from Girard, and through, they reference Dawkins, but I don't know. There's probably a bibliography there, but that's where I'm getting it from.
Dawkins is sort of like the dollar store version of his memetic, or his meme theory is, yeah, garbage, compared to Girard. So Girard would say that all culture starts with a murder. Let's say in classical mythical structures, you have one man who commits a crime, is scapegoated, is then murdered or sacrificed, is then but all the problems are made right from that sacrifice and then is made into a god. And that's usually where the culture kind of extends from. And Gerard's done a lot of work on kind of proving that. But the fundamental thing here is that from the murder, from the act of violence, you can say from in the Bible for Christians, it's Cain and Abel would be the original murder. And that gives birth to a whole idea of what right and wrong is. Like, morality is born out of that story and how people deal with it and what will bind people together. When we get to civilization capital, we'll talk about that regio. But that regio is held together essentially by, if we take the worst of the worst, a worst act to work against, that's where we begin to understand, let's say, the concept of sacrifice in order to subdue or to control that action. So oftentimes we, let's say in antiquity, but even now, we make sacrifices in order to make sure violence doesn't erupt constantly. And as our ability to make proper sacrifices erodes, the chances of violence begins to rise, which is, and this, I'll throw this another little thing out that is a something I've been talking quite a bit about, is that I believe that the coming spirit of the age is going to be the vengeful son. And part of that, you know, sort of born from the tyrannical father of the great generation of the late 19th, early 20th century, giving way to the devouring mother of, let's say, the 60s, all the way up to the woke kind of semi-present, and then now into the vengeful son spirit, which will be, I think, acts of total violence, but violence in every dimension. So it won't be just kinetic. It'll be, you'll start seeing it, you know, my best example is the Game Stonks thing that happened back in 2020 or 2021. And one of the lead guys there who was telling everyone to hold the stonks and bleed them, you know, bleed out the hedge fund that they were shorting. And people were telling him, like, hey, if you keep doing this, you're going to lose all your money. And he's like, I don't care. He's like, that's not the purpose. The purpose is not to get rich. The purpose is to hurt them, because these are the same people who hurt my dad back in 2008 and 2009. That's the vengeful son. That's I will hurt you in ways that you can't even. You can't even deal with. So I think we're coming into that spirit, and from everything from Elon Musk telling Bob Iger to go F himself and all the things, right? Like, you're seeing it more and more and more. And I think you're going to see acts of random violence start to become normal in some way.
So one thing I want to get into there, it's interesting you bring up that sort of scapegoat theory, because the first thing my mind went to is Romulus and Remus, right? And that murder, which kind of spawned Rome. Mm-hmm. And traditionally the answer, and obviously this is such an emblematic story, there's a million takes on it, right? To say takes about something in classical antiquity sounds wrong, but you understand my point. Yep. Is that, you know, essentially, you know, Romulus killed Remus for crossing, you know, the walls of Rome. You know, the walls of Rome didn't exist. He sort of laid them out with stones. And, you know, Remus walked over without asking it. You know, and that was seen to be such a violation of what Rome was that he killed him. You know, and so it's interesting that sort of initial violence provides the sort of blueprint for, you know, the civilizational spirit going forward. But to talk about the kind of spirit of the age and the vengeful son, I think you're seeing that in other ways as well, right? Like, recently it's been revealed that, you know, a couple guys on 4chan have come up with this AI that will go through, and I can't forget what they're calling it, but it's something called like it's got some sort of clever name to it, but it's an image editor that will go over, you know, a picture of a woman, edit out her tattoos, you know, put her in a modest dress, you know, make her basically look traditional, and then basically just post it in the comments, you know. And the idea in that is that's pure just mimetic psychic terror, right? You're just making someone feel bad, you know, because you are the sort of degraded version of what you could be. And, you know, from a Christian perspective, that's not good, right? That's just pure kind of like social malice. But it does kind of fit into that prism that you're talking about, right? That much like, you know, just bleeding the economy, you know, but young men who feel kind of bled by the dating economy, you know, by the sexual marketplace, to use a word from a sphere I don't particularly enjoy, but are basically decided like, well, if I can't win at all, if there's no way for me to get out of this intact, well, screw you. You know, like I'm just going to burn it down. And obviously I think that, you know, much is made of incels, but I think that that is a similar reaction. You know, it's essentially like there is no place for me in the system. So why will I give it anything?
No, absolutely. I mean, we saw this in the fall of the Soviet Union, where the Soviet Union basically fell. There's many multiple reasons, but one of the leading factors was everyone just checked out. They stopped producing capital, and the civilization just went, collapsed, and that was it. You know, the classic line from the Soviets was, "We pretend to work; they pretend to pay us." Well, you can't do like that. That's why you get Chernobyl. That's why you get everything falling apart. That's why when they went to war in Afghanistan, like just the equipment failures were just absolutely common. And no one had confidence, and no one wanted to fight for what, you know, no one wanted to fight for the motherland anymore. This wasn't World War II. You know, this wasn't the fight for existential existence. This was a fight to extend communism or the Soviet Empire further out, but no one believed in the empire. So it's like, why would we sacrifice for this? It doesn't make sense. And that just collapses empires, civilizations, everything.
Well, certainly. And, you know, this is not the order that I wanted to bring up this topic, but it's certainly one that we have to address, which is the idea of, you know, a political formula. And this is something we get from Mosca, who's kind of one of the, you know, the leading figures in elite theory, right? One of the original Italians. And the idea of a political formula is essentially the justification a ruling class has for why they're in power, right? And to kind of paraphrase, you know, my friend Academic Agent, he has this kind of like, you know, witty one-liner where he says, BS, 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 therefore I rule. The point is, the stuff on the front end doesn't really matter. It's a justification for why I'm in charge. So, you know, we've mentioned the kind of previous era of the devouring mother. Let's take the political formula of the devouring mother. And that is essentially you, member of X minority group, member of X, you know, part of the Rainbow Coalition, were previously downtrodden, you were oppressed, and we, you know, the ruling class, lifted you up. You know, we enabled you to have, you know, abortion, you know, access to XYZ career, therefore we are in charge. And there's an implicit threat in that. You know, I always go back to this line by Joe Biden, and this is like old Joe Biden, you know, back in the Obama era. But this would have been 2012 when he was campaigning against Mitt Romney. But he's in front of a group of black folks at a church, and he says, you know, people like Mitt Romney, they want to put y'all back in chains. And that is a iteration of the ruling formula, or the political formula rather, why they rule. But the problem is there has to be a moral unity between the rulers and the people. Because when there's a gap between the two, we see either a new political formula, a new ruling class emerge, right? Which is what happened in the French Revolution. Or we see what happened at the end of the Soviet Union, which is that effectively it just falls apart. It goes away. No one believes in it anymore, and it loses its power. The Chinese have a concept of this, right? The mandate of heaven, which is essentially that everyone has to believe the gods want you in charge. And once that goes away, that sort of like ephemeral it factor, that X goes away, no one obeys you. You know, no one believes in it anymore. And I think that the comparison to the Soviet Union is particularly apt, right? Because we are kind of ruled by this crumbling gerontocracy, you know, this collection of 80-year-olds who can barely, you know, summon the will to show up in the morning. You're like Dianne Feinstein literally voting while she's dying, right? It's incredibly apt comparison.
Yeah, no, it's sort of like, it must smell like a crypt inside of the Senate or Congress kind of halls. It's just like, you just get these weird ghoulish things. Like, my God, I remember when you were around, like you were around when I was a kid. Why are you still there? Like, what, no one else can do this job. Like, how can you possibly have an 80-year-old, and no matter how spry or intelligent they are, and, you know, maybe a wealth of wisdom, they're not checked into society. Like, their cares are not about the next 20 years, they're going to be dead in 20 years, you know, or in a home, or, you know, whatever have you, or hooked up to, you know, Neuralink or something. Like, it's not going to happen. And I think that's almost the best case for a cutoff time, you know, like a term limit or an age limit. Someone's saying, like, after maybe 65, we're not interested in what you have to say politically, anyways, socially, economically, because you're still going to be affected by it, but not for that long, right? People who are in their 20s certainly have a much more vested interest in making sure this thing works long term than someone who's like 75 years old.
Well, it's weird because we didn't used to have this problem, right? Like, we've had aged politicians, obviously, you know, kind of advances in medicine have made this more viable. You know, just not that many people lived into their 80s 100 years ago. But I think that, you know, one of the many things that affects this is just that, you know, people don't view themselves as part of a kind of a contiguous chain anymore. You know, this is something that, you know, Hoppe talks about. You know, essentially, when you sort of have this system, and Land echoes it, right, where you are incentivized to kind of burn, like, smoke them while you got them. You know, like, I may only be here for 4 years. You know, I sort of get the most bang for my buck by just squeezing as much as I can out. You know, anything I leave will be used against me. And, you know, Land has this great line. I've been going back through the Dark Enlightenment, as I do every couple of years. I'd really recommend it. You can find it for free on Skeptical Wave's YouTube channel, or Imperium Press has a hard copy of it. But he has this line, and it's great, where he says that the thrifty politician is an evolutionary dead end, and the, you know, the Darwinian forces of politics will squeeze him out of existence. And that point is basically that, you know, Land expresses it slightly better than I kind of quoted him there. But effectively, there's literally no incentive for them, both because, you know, many of these people are sort of like, you know, intrinsically selfish baby boomers, but also just because of the way politics is set up. Like, why would they? Why would they care about the future? They're set up, you know, they're millionaires 100 times over. And I have nothing but contempt for these people.
Well, let's just do a little bit house cleaning for a second. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for watching so far. Thank you for everyone in the chat. If you want to send us your super chats, any questions for Jay, send us a super chat. I'll read them out near the end of the show. We will be going over to the private members, the Friends Not Feds member show after the we're going to do an hour. We might do another extra half hour with Jay. He's gracious, giving us some more time, where we'll continue the conversation or talk about, well, I don't know, whatever, whatever's on my X feed. So that's $2 to join. That's I'm a grifter. I'm just not very good at it. So please sign up and join. Thank you, everyone who's listening on podcatchers and all the rest of it. We appreciate you. Please like, subscribe, send us a rating, a 5-star. I don't know. There's, I don't know, whatever the thing that you're listening to lets you do positively. We appreciate you. And there'll be more and more of these conversations coming. All right. Let's segue a little bit. You mentioned elite theory. I can have you explain elite theory. I'm going to assume that people who are tuning in watching this have a decent idea of it, or at least they've been using it without understanding it. So we might just let that slide. What I'm more interested in talking about is the counter elite theory, with sort of the rising counter elite that Matt Erickson on Kingpill and I have been talking about. I know he's going on Pete Canonas, I think, next week to talk more about the PayPal Mafia. We're going to do a PayPal Mafia Friend or Fed the beginning of March. Jay, I'll give you the invite now. No pressure. But it should be a good one, because we are speculating that we're probably closer to the French Revolution than the Russian, than the collapse of the Soviet Union. Because we started poking around. Okay. Vivek Ramaswamy is running for president, or was. And I was looking at him going, man, I feel like just the way he's talking and the way he's presenting things, and this is before he even started really pulling out NRX talking points and, you know, dropping, you know, hey, go read James Burnham on I forget the Comedians podcast. And this is before, you know, even before Curtis showed up on Charlie Kirk, which was a mind-blowing kind of experience. But so Vivek's running, and I'm like, this feels like he's connected to Peter Thiel or Elon, someone. This feels very Peter Thiel. You know, Peter Thiel's been bankrolling guys like J.D. Vance, Mark Gates, Masters run in Arizona, which he's running again. I think he's going to win. Like, this feels very Peter Thiel triangulation. And then we started digging into it, and we find out, oh, yeah, he's totally connected to all these guys. And this whole entire group, which is kind of called the PayPal Mafia, you know, we have Elon Musk, Peter Thiel, Botha, who's like the son of the foreign minister from the ex-apartheid South Africa. There's quite a few South Africans in that group, actually. And these are all major investors, and there's a whole bunch more. There's a bunch of major investors who all seem to work together in one form or another, who have basically created or invested in PayPal, YouTube, LinkedIn. The list goes on and on and on. Coinbase. And certainly, once you get into that frame of thinking, like, maybe this is the new counter elite showing up, a lot of things start making sense in terms of, why is Elon Musk going to the border and talking about this? Why did he take over X and suddenly just take the boot off people's throats by this much? And the official narrative has completely collapsed and turned on its head. You now have Trump. I think Vivek Ramaswamy is probably one of the forerunners for the VP position, and if not, probably going to have some sort of voice in that campaign, if not the presidency, if Trump gets in or if they instill him. Yeah, what are your thoughts on all of that? Because I mean, like I said, that's a lot, but I'm getting really, really hopeful. Not because I think any of these guys are our guys or our friends, and who knows what their, you know, future ambitions are, but at least they are competent. Like, they prize competency. In fact, their entire industry, like their whole shtick, runs on competency. If they don't have competency, they don't have anything.
Well, certainly. So let's start with the kind of base, the kind of thesis statement of elite theory. And that is essentially that an organized minority always wins over a disorganized majority. That's just the basic thesis of the whole thing. And because of that, you know, and you know, I've mentioned before that I consider myself a realist, you know, in the kind of the tradition of Machiavelli, where it is, you know, we look at the system as it is, not how I want it to be. So, you know, for any listeners who aren't familiar with my work, don't look at this as Jay Burden likes that this is the case. It simply is. And so, you know, within that, you know, we obviously are ruled by an oligarchy. I and many others would make the case that that's just how human civilizations function. You'll never really get away from that in any system. But obviously, like you've said, these elites change. And there are kind of several ways they can change. Because again, we go back to that core thesis of organized minority, which is one, they can become disorganized. I don't necessarily think we're seeing that. The apparatus of power, you know, the elites, when you can see them, they seem to be on brand on certain things. You know, they're talking about the issues they like to talk about. So that's not necessarily what it is. Or there's another way, which we've already mentioned with political formulas, which is that they can lose the mandate of heaven. People can stop believing in them. I think that is somewhat the case. I don't think that's going to be the determinant factor here. And the thing that you mentioned, I think, is very likely, you know, what's going to be the case, which is essentially that they have gotten incompetent, that they are bad at doing anything other than extracting political capital from the system. They're adding too much drag to sort of the engine of society. And so that opens up an angle, right, for sort of this dissident faction within the elite. Because don't get me wrong, men like Peter Thiel, men like Musk, are elites. They're incredibly wealthy. They, you know, have vast power compared to you or I. But the problem is, you know, the way the ship is currently going, it's squeezing them out. You know, they're in a position where, you know, as things currently stand, it's getting harder and harder for them to run their businesses. You know, there's sort of a multitude of ways this starts happening, but I think the easiest one is the competence crisis, right? That effectively the civil rights regime, as manifested by HR, has made it more and more difficult to run an effective, efficient company. And don't get me wrong, you know, I don't believe that efficiency is the highest goal of a civilization. I don't think that that will lead to like eternal like well-being. But we're in a situation now where there's active discrimination towards people like you and I across the entire West. Thanks, man. And in comparison, right, this sort of like ultra efficiency minded, you know, desire to run society as just a simple equation is a huge improvement. And so, again, my point in this is to say that I think that that's what's happening, is we're essentially seeing a split within the regime, where if the kind of DEI initiative keeps going, it's going to be very, very difficult for these PayPal mafia guys to maintain the kind of human capital they need to run their business. They need to keep themselves in power. And so, you know, much like Julius Caesar, you know, he doesn't become Caesar until he has no option, right? Until his back is against the wall. He's either going to lose his power, his life at best, or he's going to cross the Rubicon. And I'm not trying to over-romanticize Musk, over-romanticize Thiel, but I think that, you know, increasingly they're being put in a space, and let's not count Eric Prince out of this, who I think is in a very similar situation as well, mm-hmm. where, you know, in order for that section of the elite to have any kind of workable outcome, they're going to have to break. And again, I want to reiterate, this doesn't mean that they're our guys, that it's going to be based world. But it does mean, just like we saw on X, and that seems to be slightly changing as Musk has been forced to sort of kiss the ring. But all the same, right, you're 100% right that once that boot is off your neck, you're able to get a whole lot done. And from our perspective, right, we've talked about a circulation within the elite, you know, that it's Pareto has this idea of the ruling and the non-ruling elite. And we can consider the ruling elite those guys who are currently, you know, making their will be done. You know, the non-ruling elite are kind of the guys who are within striking distance of it. You know, and we can consider that sort of a moderate change within the regime. But in a bigger picture term, oftentimes elites come from the people below that, right? The middle. But that requires a significantly bigger shakeup. And don't get me wrong, when I look at our guys, the kind of people I'd want to be an elite, we are certainly a minority, but we're not organized. And the current kind of rulers of our society are making it very difficult for us to organize, most likely deliberately because of that same mechanism I've talked about. And so, you know, from a certain perspective, I'm not a liberal. I'm not a free speech absolutist. I think that those are both kind of false gods. But at the same time, when people who believe that are in power, it makes it much, much easier for me to get what I've done, or get done what I want done, to put it bluntly.
Slight little bit of pushback, but this I think will get us into civilizational capital nicely, is that I don't think, formally they're making it hard for us to organize. The informally, the problem is we have nothing to organize to up until now. Like, you can get into the libertarian, like, spread the message, like, wake people up. Okay, let's say you wake everyone up. Everyone's awake. They're all awake now. Well, now what? End world hunger, end the Fed, reduce taxes, get rid of all the illegal immigrants. Like, it's just building, it's Sisyphusian, right? Like, they're building mountains upon mountains upon mountains that, even if you climb the first impossible feat, you then have all the other ones ahead of you that don't make sense anyways. And I don't understand where the spec op is in order to achieve any of it. So this is something that now Matt Erickson's in the chat. We've been developing. I have the conversations over on my Substack. I have some of them in the members only. I'll be putting them out this weekend for general consumption. As we move forward, we've been reading Moldberg's Patchwork and combining it with this idea of civilizational capital. This is something that kind of hit me when I was, it's a long story a little bit, but it started off with watching the woman trying to cross the river in the Congo on like two pieces of bamboo sticks, and everyone going, well, the world's failed Congo. And I'm like, no, the world hasn't failed Congo. She and her people live in what I would call a primal frame. And in a primal frame, everything is immediate. All your, you know, you don't build capital. Whatever you build, you spend. You just reuse things. So in quite likely the scenario, and I don't know for sure, but I wouldn't be surprised if the scenario was, well, look, this river is only here for 3 months a year during the rainy season. So we only build a very temporary small bridge there. And when it's not the rainy season or the river's not that fierce, we take that wood and reuse it for other stuff. And you can turn around and go, well, we'll just build you, you know, UNESCO will come in and build you a brick bridge, you know, something that'll last forever. And you don't have to worry about it. You just have to maintain it. And that's the problem. There's no maintenance in a primal frame. And it's not, I'm not even saying this is good or bad. It just is. Sorry, my daughter is co-producing. So
oh, no worries.
It's cute, but it's distracting. So if you build that brick bridge and you go back in 6 months, you'll find the bridge gone, and they'll repurposed it for an oven or something like that, because that's what they needed. That's just the reality they live in. For a civil frame or a civilization's frame, we do things differently because we're building into the future. We're building this capital and reinvesting it. And as you invest it, you're getting these returns, which allows you to build and build more and more civilization. So that's the two kind of, let's say, framing. When you're in the civilizational frame, how is that possible? Well, I'm saying that there's a thing called civilizational capital. And this is building from a land concept, which says that capital is essentially the product of human competency. So the more competent people are, the more capital they produce. Matt Erickson and I have kind of come up with an idea that civilizations have three major domains: the social, the economic, and the political. That's where you kind of generate and invest political capital. These three domains are held together by a regio. A regio can mean either a region, a king, or a religion, or all three. And in fact, the strongest ones are all three. So what we've seen with liberalism or nominalism or individualism, pick your poison, is that they've essentially started to erode all of these. They've eroded the regio pretty much out of the civilization. So they got rid of a religion, they've gotten rid of the king or leadership, and now they're basically getting rid of the state. What that does is it makes the three domains start to go to war with each other. They start to cannibalize each other to get that capital from somewhere. Whatever they produce, they're spending, or someone else is taking it from them. They're no longer working in unison to build this thing. One of the examples I said in the last reading, and sorry, I'll just finish this point and throw it back to you, Jay, to get your thoughts on this. But if you look at 1991, the fall of the Soviet Union, right, the end of the Cold War, massive achievement. I remember I was 12 years old in 89 when the Berlin Wall fell, and I watched this history unfold. And there was a sense, amazing sense of optimism. And everyone was like, there was a celebratory mood throughout the 90s that if you weren't, you know, of a certain age during them, you just don't understand. You can't really access that. And what's stunning to me looking back on it is, with all that capital freed up, with all this like enthusiasm and money and resources and everything, we didn't build anything. Like, what great monuments or works of art, heroic epics, like, you know, a Sistine Chapel, something grandiose, something even silly. Because what I'm saying is that civilizations are actually so irrational that they become super rational, that there's no good reason to make a bank beautiful other than because making a bank beautiful is good for civilization. Like, it's internally consistent, but externally kind of weird. And you look at the 90s and we didn't do it. We built strip malls.
Well, certainly. And I think that's a deeper problem, which is... Sorry,
Jay, just to interrupt for a second, just to respond to Adam Keeney in the comments. We did get POGs in the 90s. This is true. That was an achievement. However, I'm just saying I would like a statue, maybe.
Well, I think that's a deeper problem, which is essentially that no one can really answer. Not no one. the broader culture can't answer the question as to what is the purpose of society, you know, beyond just kind of like satisfying your animal urges. I think that, you know, part of this is that, you know, when we look at America becoming an empire, you know, there are kind of a multiple, there are multiple stages, right? That the American empire sort of has its genesis in 1865, right? That's when it becomes sort of this like manifest destiny, you know, expansionist thing. We see the sort of like proto movements of it, you know, through the end of the 19th and early 20th century. But really it's FDR that makes America an empire. And if you look at the ruling formula, right, the political formula, the moral justification for the American empire, it's essentially Nuremberg. It is World War II and the Holocaust. That political formula is for our empire, right? Not at home, but abroad. We saved you from Satan on earth. Therefore, we're awesome and we get to rule. And okay, maybe that worked for a little bit. That was decent enough at sort of providing that kind of impetus for why we were, you know, fighting the Cold War in Europe. You know, like we're still doing it. We're still Superman fighting for you. But that war goes away and what's left? You know, even that relatively shallow, that kind of fig leaf of a justification for existence, when that disappears, what do we have left? And, you know, again, you know, we've talked about this kind of burning of social capital. But really what happened is that, you know, successive years of Harvard business graduates realized that it was much, much easier, a much safer bet to essentially make money through kind of like labor arbitrage than it was to actually do anything productive. And so I see this kind of force, obviously, you know, it affects the spiritual health, obviously it affects the economic health of the nation, but it's just kind of like decline more generally. You know, that same civilizational cycle that we see in the Old Testament, right? With obviously, you know, with God's chosen people, we see in any other number of kind of like human organizations. And to view us, the West, or us, America, as exempt from that, I think is profoundly arrogant. And again, I think that, don't get me wrong, like certainly having a competent elite in charge who didn't hate their people would make things better. But I don't think that addresses that kind of broader trend of decline. I don't think that PayPal Mafia has an answer for why America exists, for why our civilization needs to continue. And that's why they're not our guys.
Yeah. The fundamental thing that has to be reinstated in all dimensions is that regio, that sense of region, borders, leadership, and God. If you almost have to reverse engineer it back into civilization in order to get those three domains back into some sort of functional, cohesive, cooperating kind of whole. Without that, you're going to just continue this trend. The thing that I'm worried about, I think that's most likely, is that this will become a revitalizing moment. Like if, let's say they get Trump in and they get the PayPal Mafia and all those guys in to restructure everything in a sort of a Yarvin sort of style of patchwork or who knows what, right? I believe it'll be basically more of like a revitalizing moment where people will get this sense of, oh, it's good again. You know, Theo will push Girardi mimetics and make everyone kind of follow the leader and follow your models, and people will, you know, really believe in all this stuff, and it'd be great for a while. But fundamentally, if you don't have a regio that binds the civilization together, and that can, I have no idea how long that can take. That could take centuries. Traditionally has. So maybe with the technology we have now, we can make that timeline a lot smaller. But I don't know. That's kind of what we're getting to with Matt and myself, is that what we're looking to do is telling people that, look, civilization is over. You no longer live in a civilization, and you have to take that as an a priori. Like that, there's your starting position. So what do you do? Well, we build. And how do we build? We're trying to figure that out, and we're coming up with some theories. But initially, I think what we're going to say is like, let's build online. Let's start thinking of online spaces as villages, as towns. Like, we need a tribe. We need to bring the tribe together, because civilizations are still are basically built around tribes. If you think of like the acorn doesn't just become the tree. If you, the acorn was preserved inside the tree, and the tree is sort of layered out around the acorn, is probably the best icon I can think of it. And so as civilization collapses, it collapses back into the tribe. And from that tribe, it can grow back out into civilization. But these are projects that probably, you know, we can start, but probably will never finish. And these are projects that I guarantee you will fail. So it's not about having an eternity utopia. It's about producing one more stone to raise the water so the crow can drink. Because we, as Christians, especially as Orthodox Christians, or as an Orthodox Christian, I should say, we know how this ends. So it ends in the kingdom of heaven with a pretty, you know, bad period in between. But I don't think we're anywhere close to that. We're just in the, let's rebuild. Like, let's build and let's learn and let's progress this a little by little. And that's how we grow. And we grow on an individual level, on a family level, and on a civilizational level. And I think that gives me a lot more hope and, let's say, potentiality for the future.
Certainly. I think that it is important to kind of have the end in sight there, right? And one of the primary reasons that we are anti-ideology, right, is sort of that the utopianism kind of inherent to it. You know, the idea that there are sort of these kind of like eternal devils of human civilization can never be eradicated. And I think it's important to kind of put things into two boxes, right? Which is one, the kind of inherent tragedy of human life, you know, war, plague, these sort of, you know, horsemen that kind of follow us around. We're not going to get around that. But also, I think that when we look at how our elites run things, it is manifestly beyond that. You know, it's not just, oh, you know, they're greedy, they're corrupt. They seem to actively hate us and kind of hate the continued existence of the human species. And I think that it's important to kind of put that into context, where that is beyond what I view as just kind of baseline human corruption. You know, because, like, don't get me wrong, again, politicians have always enriched themselves. They've always hired their friends. That's sort of the name of the game. But I think what we see now is on such an extended level, you know, it does sort of feel like this can't go on. Either they will crash the whole thing or someone will take it from them. You're muted, Jason.
Thank you. Why do you think they, sorry, balancing toddler on the side.
No worries.
Else. Why do you think they hate us? What is it? Just resentment? Do you reckon, or is it something deeper?
I mean, I think that there's any number of things. I think that part of it is that, and actually, okay, there's a certain, and I'll just briefly touch on this. There's a certain like ethno-sectarian element to this that cannot be ignored. I don't want to get too into that because it can very easily kind of veer into tasteless territory. That's part of it, and not a small part of it. I think another part of it is that these people are social planners. You know, that if you look at what happened in Germany post-World War II, you look at Reconstruction, which the Civil Rights Act, any one of these things, it is an attempt to engineer certain facets of human nature out of existence. And if it doesn't work, they resent you. You are the reason it didn't work. So you see this in the sort of disdain that the ruling class has towards like what you would call like crackers or peckerwoods or kind of poor whites, right? They don't like them because the social engineering didn't work. They sort of kind of live the same way they always have to a certain degree. Obviously, they've sort of degenerated like the rest of us. But, you know, that attitude of libertarianism, like come and take it, is sort of the cultural attitude of those people, you know, and they kind of they've lived like that before, since, and after, kind of regardless of the amount of social engineering designed to change them. And because of that, there is this resentment built up in the regime against them. You know, it's the reason that, you know, unreconstructed for a long time was a slur. You know, it was like, if you were called an unreconstructed Southerner, it meant you were this like horrible racist hick. You know, it's basically because the social engineering didn't work. I think that's also part of it. I think genuinely, you know, and this is something that, you know, you see in Alola and Kaczynski, that they have sort of made a devil's bargain with technique, you know, with technology or with the devil. And I sort of believe that all three are very closely linked. But, you know, it's that idea that, you know, if we can control society, we ought to control everything. And, you know, much in the same way that, you know, much of that, a lot of the horrors of communism were sort of downstream of, you know, the intersection between ideology and reality. I think we see something very similar with our own elites, who want to essentially engineer things like in-group preference, who want to engineer kind of basic human difference out of existence. Because I think that the last thing, and this is very much related, is that the animating principle of the left, right, of entropy, is egalitarianism. They view that all people are the same. And when people aren't, I mean, when people are not meeting that kind of blank slate conception of human nature, that needs to be fixed. You know, that is the end goal. And when that isn't happening, well, who's to blame? It's not them. It's you. You know, again, to paraphrase Hegel, or to paraphrase Land, I can't remember which one, you know, if the facts don't conform to ideology, all the worse for the facts. You know, essentially that we will, you know, we will conform reality to our desires, I guess, is the core conception of all of those.
Brilliantly put. See, this is why Jay the Beaver Burden is one of the fastest running rising stars in the distant sphere, folks. That was fire, sir. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
So I've sent you the link for the private members chat. We'll wrap up here. Anyone who's listening to this on YouTube or off YouTube can always come over and join. Come over, check the site. There'll be links over there to come join the $2 membership, friend or fed, private members hang. We'll do a little bit more vamping talking. You sent me something over here that we'll get to.
Oh, no, I just sent I sent an image of the AI software I was referring to. Just so that I'm not completely like, you know, talking out of my ass, but
no. I've been starting to see this kind of creep up all over the place. Maybe we can get into neo-traditionalism as well. That could be kind of fun.
Sure.
So anyone listening, come and join us there. Anyone in the future, just do the thing, Johnny, watch the thing. Jay, any last thoughts, any last words? Tell the people where they can get at you.
Sure. So my primary output is the Jay Burden Show. It's a roughly 3-time a week, 2-time a week, hour-long interview show. I've interviewed people you have likely heard of. I talk to Thomas quite often. I've talked to Buck Johnson, King Pilled. I'd like to have you on, Jason, soon. And in addition to that, I also have a Substack, also found at the Jay Burden Show, if you want to hear my thoughts kind of at length. But you can find my show on Apple, Spotify, YouTube, anywhere you listen to podcasts. And again, thank you so much for having me, Jason. It was a great time.
Oh, man. Absolutely my pleasure. So, folks, if everyone's asking for member hang, I'm posting it again in the chat. Give me 2 seconds. See, I'm an authentic podcast. This is what we are. Like, you know, the two-bit thing is a multifaceted term. It's just in case anyone starts thinking like this is getting too professional. We just bring amazing guests and some cool ideas. The production side is, you know.
Well, see, here's the way to do dumb, it. But literally never do anything new. Just have such a formulaic, not like content wise, but just like every show has these beats. Like I got a intro, outro, chill at the end. I press the same buttons and I still manage to mess it up. So having moving parts is just asking for trouble.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. I'm trying to reduce things down to the most simplistic terms possible. It's like binary. Like I press button. Did this work? Is this on? I don't know. Hi guys. Anyone watching numbers? Oh, yeah, this is, I'm a poor representative of the podcast scene, but we're doing our best, folks. I appreciate everyone who's watching and listening. Give us a like, give us a share, tell people about us, because that's always nice. It's nice to have people watching, and I appreciate each and every one of you. We will sign out here, give about a 15-minute break, and so I can go be a dad for 2 seconds. And then we will reconvene in the members only hang. The link is up there. The link is should be a link in the description below as well. If you're having trouble finding us, and Jay, we'll see you there.